Okay, thanks. Thanks very much, Tony, and thanks for the invite to come up to Newcastle. I suppose an element of a certain sense of weariness that here we are holding a meeting to stop the war on Iraq again. Although I like the, I'm a sort of magpies when it comes to sort of assembling bits for speeches. And this is a quote from Einstein, definition of insanity is doing the same thing again and again and expecting different results. I shall use that because that does fit the situation perfectly. When Parliament voted to go to war, it's 2 weeks ago, it's the third time that Britain has been at war in or with Iraq over the last generation. The Gulf War in 1991, which was followed, let's not forget, by a decade of brutal economic sanctions which killed 500,000 Iraqi children, a price the American government at the time said was worth paying. Then the war of 2003, sold to us, as we all know, on the basis of lies and undoubtedly completely illegal, no ifs or buts about it on that occasion, that led to a terrible occupation. Who knows how many Iraqis died then, perhaps as many as 1 million, certainly 4 million were displaced, driven into internal or external exile, a country destroyed. And now, here we go again, in what has been told is the latest round in the seemingly endless war on terror. Because apart from what's been done to Iraq, one could mention what's happened in Afghanistan, where the British Army is scheduled to leave at the end of this year after 13 years of achieving nothing. And we have the destruction of Libya, which you may remember 3 years ago, that was going to be the good war, the one that was going to work. And we have left it a country in a state of complete anarchy and collapse. You wouldn't think you could have worse regimes than they had before, but now they have. And that's not including even the sort of smaller drone wars in which some guy sitting in Utah or Oklahoma pilots a drone that then kills either a terrorist or perhaps a wedding party in Pakistan or Yemen or Somalia. This whole war on terror that has so far achieved absolutely or virtually nothing at all and has spread death and hatred and chaos across a huge swathe of the world, the Middle East and South Asia primarily. And now we've been told one more heave, one more enemy to deal with, one more reason for bombing, and this time we're going to get it right. And I think it's good that this meeting has been organised, and the first lesson that we need to be drawing from these events is the need to revive the work of the anti-war movement and the Stop the War Coalition, because if any of us thought that the vote, welcome vote in Parliament a year ago to not go to war against Syria, but that meant that the tide had turned permanently on this question, then unfortunately we were wrong. But here is just an irony, just in passing. A year ago, David Cameron, and for that matter Obama, were saying we need to go to war in Syria to attack the Assad government. Had they got away with it, had that war happened, had the Assad government been bombed and possibly brought down, then ISIS, they would be in power in Damascus, more likely than not. And so now that the enemy we're now having to bomb in Syria is the one that was fighting against Assad, who we were wanting to bomb last year. I just make that point in case there's anyone in this room or anywhere that think our politicians know what they're doing, that they're not just making it up as they go along, clutching at one straw after another, or perhaps, I'll use this metaphor, one hammer after another to deal with every problem. Because now it's ISIS, or ISIL. I think ISIS is easier to say, so I'll stick with that. They are now the excuse for intervention. Now, I don't think there's anyone here who would disagree that ISIS is barbarous, and there's certainly no one here who wouldn't have the most profound sympathy for the family of Alan Henning and other hostages who've had either apparently died a most brutal death or may still be detained under the shadow of that death. But is that really what this is all about? We know that the war on terror has from the very beginning been accompanied by propaganda and by extraordinary lies. We know the weapons of mass destruction that Saddam Hussein was going to use, that were going to land on Britain in 45 minutes from him deciding he wanted to launch them, that was a complete lie. The stories about, I remember just one example, front page of The Observer in late 2001, when anthrax had been sent in envelopes to certain leading American politicians. And the headline was "Saddam Link to Anthrax Letters." Now, it turned out the anthrax had been sent by a disgruntled professor in New Jersey. I mean, luckily someone explained that that was an American state, George Bush, before he started bombing it. But that correction was tucked away on page 28 a month later, and people by that point had the idea there's some horror here we have to intervene against. And without giving any ground to conspiracy theories, let alone trying to say that ISIS is any better than it is, here again we have a drumbeat of propaganda designed to create a climate where war again becomes acceptable, where what they were calling the syndrome that stopped them going to war, but which we would call the mass pressure of public opinion for most of this century, that finally won a victory when we stopped that attack on Syria a year ago, to try and manipulate opinion to break that that syndrome, to get the green light to deploy armed forces in the most volatile region in the world. Because really what is happening now cannot, in my view, stop ISIS, if that was the stated aim. ISIS is a creation of the last Iraq war, above all. ISIS is thriving where states have collapsed, and in the case of Iraq, the collapse of the Iraqi state is something wholly on the account of the American and British occupation installed after 2003. It would have been possible to remove Saddam, if one had wanted to, without having the wholesale destruction of the state and its piecemeal reconstruction on a sectarian basis. When the Americans went in there, their first governing council set up was going to have so many Shia, so many Sunni, and so many Kurds. Lining Iraq up on a sectarian and ethnic basis, a recipe for a dysfunctional state, never mind that the civil service and the Iraqi army were all completely dispersed as well. For what we've had in Iraq under American sponsorship is a sectarian government that has alienated vast sections of the population, and where the basic functions of the state have completely collapsed. I think George Galloway was right when he said in the House of Commons, he got howled down because people didn't like to hear it, that actually in Iraq, ISIS could not have established control over the territory they have. There's only supposed to be about 10,000 ISIS fighters. They're controlling an area the size of Britain or bigger. Unless they had some support from the Sunni population in those areas, or at least the Sunni population regarded whatever ISIS's form of administration is as better than the one of the sectarian government in Iraq. Syria, of course, the story is somewhat different. There's a civil war there. Britain and other Western powers have been pouring arms and money into that, if not troops. And as I said already, with the bizarre thing, they haven't actually saw which side they're actually supporting, but that has led to the collapse of the state in large areas of Syria. So this is a vacuum. This is the territory that ISIS has moved to fill. And they will not and cannot be defeated simply by bombing. I'm leaving aside now the moral and the political arguments, but purely on a practical thing. I think Obama has said today, we're not going to defeat ISIS by bombing. Well, that is absolutely obvious. You could, by bombing, perhaps stop ISIS advancing in particular directions if they were marching along the main road with black banners flying. But you can't actually, a relatively small force embedded in the civilian population, either you're going to do what Andy has just said and have enormous collateral damage, or you're only going to contain it at the most. So that is why I think it is not wrong to say we've been set up for a form of mission creep. Well, already there's probably special forces on the ground, but sooner or later, if you're serious about defeating ISIS, it could only either be you've got an Iraqi state strong enough with popular support to take them on, a Syrian state in Syria, or a third force militarily coming in, which, of course, is most likely to be the American and British armed forces. A lot has been made of, oh, well, we've got Arab allies for this operation. That only compounds the irony. Bahrain, which has slaughtered its own pro-democracy movement and which has people who want freedom in Bahrain tortured and imprisoned. The UAE, Qatar, similarly despotic governments. Jordan, a puppet British monarchy for the last 50 years. None of them would have to have a parliamentary vote, that's for sure. And best or worst of all, Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, which actually beheads more people in a week than ISIS has done altogether so far. They behead people for sorcery and all sorts of other real and imagined crimes. And they are supposed to be our partner in this bombing for freedom. And it's doubly ironic in the case of Saudi Arabia, because the growth and the strength of extreme fundamentalist views in the Muslim world has a lot to do with the Wahhabi ideology of the Saudi clerics and a sort of a Faustian pact made years ago where they endorse the ruling family in Saudi Arabia, the House of Saud. In a turn, the Saud ruling family uses the money and the wealth they get from oil to fund Wahhabi propaganda throughout the Muslim world. And if one was serious about defeating fundamentalism in the Muslim world, well, that's obviously a matter for Muslims themselves to decide how and when and if to do that. But the very least is Britain and America could stop being hand in glove with the Saudi regime purely because of oil, when the Saudi regime is the most reactionary force in the Middle East and is at the heart of an awful lot of the problems there. So the whole situation that we're confronting is largely of our making. This war is the product of the last one. And if, by some means or other, eventually ISIS were to be defeated, if nothing else changes, there will be another set of problems. I mean, Andy is right when he says the people themselves on the ground have to address these problems. They have to be allowed to find the solutions which correspond to their own desires without endless external interference. Today, we're intervening because ISIS is the problem. In 1956, we intervened against Arab nationalism. Since then, we sometimes supported Ba'athism, sometimes intervened against it. We supported Gaddafi, we've overthrown his Green Book regime. We supported monarchs, we've interfered here, we supported Israel in attacking one government after another, we helped overthrow a democratic government in Iran in the 1950s. The fact is, this isn't about ISIS. This is about anything that is not under the control of Britain and the US and our allies to try and control the resources and the people of the whole of the Middle East. And what we're doing now is not only not going to make things better, it is storing up still further trouble going forward. Including, let's be frank, trouble for ourselves. I mean, we always talk about blowback under these circumstances. I think blowback has hardly ever come faster than when one day, a Friday, the House of Commons votes for war. On Monday, Theresa May, the Home Secretary, is standing up at the Tory Party conference announcing a whole package of measures in which extremists, however they're to be defined, probably half of this room might fall into it for all I know, are going to be banned from the television. There's going to be peaceful organisations that don't act violently or promote violence are going to be somehow put under some form of sanction. And these are civil liberties, which, as we all know from the past, when governments introduce attacks on civil liberties, they always say it's to deal with these people for this length of time, but it ends up dealing, of course, with these people for this length of time, because once it's on the books, governments use it to try and control all forms of opposition. We're getting backlash in terms of Islamophobia, where Muslims are being demanded, unless they announce, swear three times before breakfast that they hate ISIS and have nothing to do with it, they're sort of under suspicion. Why should British citizens who are of the Muslim faith have to answer that question? And what happened to the presumption of innocence? This is stirring up, and it feeds into the anti-immigrant rhetoric that's generally around as well, dividing our society and playing into ignorance and hatred. I'm going to get blowback as well. We've got austerity. Everyone says we've got to be austere. We can't afford to spend any money on the things that people really need. Every time one of his RAF tornadoes takes off from Cyprus and circles round and looks for something to bomb and then comes back, maybe having bombed or maybe not, and lands at Akatiri in Cyprus, that's the cost of another school. Every time they take off and go around. I mean, it's, every bomb that's dropped, that's £100,000 to replace it, to keep munitions stocks up. So, and these things will get worse. And let's also be honest. Is this going to make it more likely? Good evening, officer. Going to make it more likely that people are going to commit terrorism in this country? Well, it will make it more likely there's going to be terrorism in this country, because the hatred that these sort of things stir up, the poison that is injected into world politics, does have an impact in Britain itself. So, what should we do? What's the agenda for us? We have to take these arguments out to the public to explain what is going on. I mean, according to opinion polls, about 30 to 35% of people think this war is wrong. That's clearly, obviously, a minority. It's a bigger minority than at the start of the Afghan war, when people were perhaps understandably influenced by 9/11 and were worried about the threat of terrorism. Of course, it didn't take all that long before they realised that war and the Iraq war were absolute disasters. So we have to take those arguments out to people. We have to rebuild the connections that were made by the Stop the War movement in the past, get that strength and that coalition, that unity of people of different faiths, Christian, Muslim, or no faith at all, politicians of all sorts. One good thing about the vote in the House of Commons was every single party, there were some people who voted against the war. It wasn't just a Labour minority. There were people from the Liberal Dems, the Conservatives, the Scottish Nationalists, the Green MP, of course, Respect and Plaid Cymru. So there is a base for support there. But we have also to answer the question. Some people say, don't we have a moral obligation to do something? When people see barbarity and problems, there's often a feeling that we have to do something. But sometimes it's harder to necessarily get over that actually it's not us deciding what we're going to do, it'd be our government deciding what to do. Whatever they decide to do is going to make things worse. What do we have a moral responsibility for in the Middle East? We have a moral responsibility, Britain, the British government I mean, for the partition of Palestine. We have a moral responsibility for the overthrow of democracy in Iran in the 1950s and the dictatorship of the Shah. We have a moral responsibility for supporting Israel through its blockades of Gaza and its occupation of Palestinian land for the last 50 years and more. We have a moral responsibility for all those deaths in Iraq under sanctions and war. We have a moral responsibility for our support for dictatorships like those in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia. We have a moral responsibility for the state of Libya today, destroyed by our bombing. We have a moral responsibility for all of that. So I think we have to get over that now our moral responsibility is not to do anything. It's not to interfere. It's not to start new wars. It's not to cause more deaths. It's not to poison another generation around the world. Our responsibility is to demand peace and to allow the people of the Middle East to shape their own future. Thank you.